Yeah. Great stuff. Good morning again. I just say as I start, I'm by no means the foremost expert or an expert even in evangelism. I'm just someone who loves Jesus and wants to tell people about him. And I often fail, I often get it wrong. So I just want to get that little disclaimer out there. I'm not a massive, massive expert, but I love talking to people about Jesus. Also, just to say as we begin, if you've got questions as we're going along, feel free to just pop your hand up or shout at me if I can't quite hear you or see you or whatever, and just fire away your questions as we're going along. I guess the first session would be more kind of me speaking from the front. There'll be a lot of that kind of happening, but as we go through the other sessions, a bit more interaction as well. But as I say, if you want to interrupt me or interject at any point, feel free to do so, and if we've got the time, we can go with where you're going, and we'll see how things pan out. But what I really want to do over the four sessions is I want us to begin, which is today's the first session, by thinking a bit about the spirit of the age, by thinking about how people in general think. Obviously, you've got to, as we'll see a bit later, we've got to contextualise, we've got to think about the people we're speaking to personally. But I want us to think about broadly, what is the spirit of the age in which we live? What is our, if you like, our culture like? Then we're going to come on to then what is the gospel, because it's always pretty handy to know what it is we're trying to speak into people's lives and into that context. Then we're going to have a session thinking about chatting about Jesus, how we can just have kind of natural conversations and how God can enable us really to do that well. And then the final session, we'll think about how to answer tricky questions that get thrown at us. And we'll look at some different approaches, but basically we're going to go with Jesus' approach to everything today. So let's begin then with the spirit of the age. Nick's prayed for us, which has been brilliant, and we're going to crack on then with thinking a bit about the spirit of the age. So firstly, what is culture? Well, Mark Green of London Institute of Contemporary Christianity, I think he defines it really well in the resource Fruitfulness on the Front Line. He says culture is the way we do things around here. I think it's a really good kind of short overview of what culture is, the way we do things around here. So what we kind of believe, how we act, that kind of notion. And so we're going to think about that, and we're going to think about what's going on in our culture, firstly. How did we get here? Why is this taking place according to what the Bible says? And then we're going to think about what do we need to do in response to this. So firstly, what's going on? I want us to look at the cultural air people are breathing in. And when people we chat to who aren't Christians, what we've got to always realise is that every single person we talk to has a view of the world, a way of seeing life. For most people, a lot of people, they wouldn't have spent ages thinking through coherently, this is what I think and this is why and here are the reasons and the outworkings of it. A lot of people just breathe in the ideas that are out there in our culture. And so I want us to kind of think about the cultural air we people are breathing in and we're breathing in as well, and see actually how it actually impacts and affects us too. But as you look out on the world, I wonder if you end up thinking you're a bit like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. You've been kind of sucked up in this world, and you've been dumped, and you feel all of a sudden as though you're no longer living in Kansas. You're in a completely alien world to the one that you grew up in, or the one that you knew 10, even 20 or so years ago. And what really is taking place is, I think, in our culture more widely, and the Bible always talks about this anyway, is that what people are wanting is people are wanting the kingdom without the king. So you see a lot of stuff about, you know, equality and human rights and justice that people love and crave, and they want all these good things, but they don't actually want the king who brings them. And there's this kind of shoveling of Jesus to the side, and people saying, we want all these other great things that actually he can only provide, but we don't want him. And I think this is really at the heart of what's going on there. There's a lot of stuff where the people want the kingdom without the king. And that is, you get this idea as well of progress. You know, you get the phrase, you're on the wrong side of history, being used by politicians and people all the time. You want to get on the right side of history. And it's the idea that we're progressing towards this kind of hopeful utopia where life will be brilliant and everything will be sorted. But the way the world, and particularly the Western world, wants to arrive at this utopia is through progress and through actually doing it without, again, the presence of Jesus. People want progress. without the presence. So what is our culture's story, if you like? Well, it kind of goes a bit like this. It goes, if you get, you know, in the Bible, we've got the creation, fall, redemption, consummation, kind of fourfold kind of understanding of the Bible, where you can kind of, you can chart that along in pretty much most films as well. Things start great, they go pear-shaped, you're looking for someone to sort it out, in the end things get sorted and people live a happy life. Well, what's our culture's kind of overarching story? Well, it's really this. In the beginning, I was good. I was innocent. There was nothing wrong with me. But then, after creation, the fall happened. And the fall was when people or society or structures around me, religion or whoever or whatever it may be, started to try to define me and say, this is who you are. This is who you should be. This is how you should live. So the fall in a kind of secular mindset is that it is people trying to define you, people trying to put their ideas onto you, their restrictions, their rules onto you. And so sin in that way of understanding life then is no longer, as we see it, rebellion against God. Sin in a secular mindset is really anything that makes me feel bad. So if you make me feel bad, you are sinning against me. And that, if you like, explains all the stuff that goes on in universities about, you know, safe spaces, or all that goes on in social media, in the Twitter sphere, where everyone just loses the plot and starts spitting nails out left, right and centre. Because no one's caring about what someone intended to say. They're just caring about how they subjectively feel about what has been said. It's all about the impact. It's all about what you feel. And if you feel bad because someone said something over there, that is sin. So sin is anything that makes me feel bad. In the last few years, some psychologists have come up with this idea of what they call concept creep. And they basically say, look, there's been these traditional kind of ideas of things like bullying and trauma. And yet what we found over the last few years is that the concept and the definition of these ideas of trauma or bullying, it's crept. It's crept outwards and it's crept down, so that embraces so much more now. And they said, on one level, that can be good. So on things like abuse, you know, things like in the past, sexual and physical abuse were just seen as abuse, but now actually emotional abuse is seen as abusive as well. And so that's a good result of it. But they're saying actually there's this massive danger as well, that the concept has crept down. So say, for example, on something like trauma. Trauma used to be the idea of this really unusual situation happening that absolutely comes into your life, that completely wrecks your life, but a very unusual situation happening to you. So even something like the death of a loved one wasn't considered to be actually under the definition of trauma. But now they say trauma has expanded so much, the definition has crept so much, you can be traumatized by someone writing Donald Trump 2016 on a university floor in America. That can be trauma because you feel terrible because of it. And you know that because when we use the word trauma, we all say it in our just normal speak, don't we? We say, oh, I felt really traumatized by that. Oh, it's a traumatic experience. And although we're kind of joking, it shows that this kind of language has crept. And it's because in our secular kind of way of seeing things, sin is anything that makes me feel bad. Sin is, I feel bad when people in society try to tell me who I should be and what I should be about, when people offend my inner sensibilities. And so what is salvation in this kind of way of understanding? Well, salvation is about rediscovering my inner self. You know, I used to be innocent and I was free from all the structures everyone put over me. But that, I fell from that when everyone started to impose what I should be and who I should be and what I should do. So what is salvation? Well, it's rediscovering my inner self. It's looking within and going, look, let's do an Elsa on it from Frozen. Even in Leicester University Students' Union, I was getting a cheeky Starbucks coffee, and this was blaring out over the sound system there. Elsa singing, you know, the classic song, "No Right, No Wrong, No Rules for Me, I'm Free." And so salvation in our world's eyes is about doing what you want, following your heart. And so when Christians come in and try and share the gospel, can you start to see that it's completely alien to everyone because they've got a completely different way of understanding and what is going on in life? Not again necessarily because they thought about it, some have, but not necessarily that they have, most haven't, but it's because this is just the ideas that are pumped out through education, through politics, through social media, etc. So you can really see these ideas as well when you watch Disney. And we've got two kids, as you've seen, and we do watch quite a few Disney films, so I'm not anti-Disney films. But what you do see is the same idea comes through all these films, which is salvation is about believing in yourself, following your heart. You know, watch Rapunzel, you see it there. It's overwhelmingly obvious, in all of them it is. But you go back to one of the early ones, The Wizard of Oz, I think it was about 1939 or 1940. And what was the idea in that? Well, Tin Woodman, you feel you've got no heart. Well, actually, look within and you find and discover that you had a heart all along. That weird-looking, freaky lion thing, which looks nothing like a lion, that look within it and you'll see, you know, you didn't think you have courage, but actually look within and you find, you discover, yes, you did. And so salvation is all about believing in yourself, trusting in your heart. And so another way of putting it is you could say in our society there's a bit of a Peter pandemic as well. I think what, you know, you see this obsession with youth, and Peter Pan is the eternal boy, and in our society we've got this obsession with wanting to be about kind of 20 years of age, and everyone is praised if they're 100 and trying to look 20 or 100 and doing these kind of things. Everyone's praised for being a, you know, if you're trying to be this eternal boy, and there's a lot of stuff about delayed adulthood as well in teens and 20s where people just aren't growing up. There's a Peter pandemic. Everyone's trying to not deal with the end because they don't like actual reality. So a lot of this stuff is going on. Just do what you feel. Go with your heart. Do your Peter Pan thing. Be whatever you want to be. Be the eternal boy. But you'll probably find this, and I'm sure you do find this, as you chat to people, as you hang out with family members who aren't Christian, friends, people you see around school or around town, what you find is that people seem to be on this never-ending, you know, this perpetual kind of treadmill or on a hamster wheel where they're just running around and running around, and they're trying to get to the goal, but they don't know what the goal is, and it's just being true to yourself, but they don't know who they are, and there's no way of them never knowing who they are. The whole self-esteem movement is just completely messed up. And so they're just running around and just going absolutely nowhere. Joss Whedon, who was very much directing the Avengers films, he made this interesting comment. He said, "There's no hope for humanity except the false hope that we create. We're doomed." And if you saw the last film, you'd probably see that idea comes through pretty clearly in the film. There's no hope for humanity except the false humanity that we create. We're doomed. And I think because people have said we want the kingdom, we want all these great things that only Jesus can give, but we don't want him, we don't want the king, then people are seeing there's no goal to life, everything is just messed up, we've arrived here by accident, we're going to live, die and rot. It's a mess, and I think a lot of people are realising that. This guy here is called Ted Tenneau, and he's not going to be in the next Avengers film or anything, but he's very good at kind of critiquing culture, and he's written a book called Popologetics, which has got a nice funky front cover to it. But anyway, he says that amidst all this kind of mayhem out there, he says that the gospel is finally the answer to the lies presented by idols found in popular culture. It is the fulfillment of the desires that motivate popular culture. It's the source of the good and true things that shine in popular culture. And I think what he's trying to get us to do is think about, you know, we could be all like despairing and just shove our heads in the sand and go, oh, we can't, let's get away, let's go off to another island and cut ourselves off from everyone. But he's saying, no, let's start to engage them with the way people are thinking and the way people are feeling. Let's try and help people see that the gospel is the answer to all the longings that they have, that Jesus is the answer to all those things, that he's the fulfillment of these deep desires they have, and he's the answer to the lies, etc. So, again, as you look at society, do you see this? Do you see the anger and anxiety? It's not just the white van man who's getting road rage. It's everyone, all of us, just getting angry. Someone cuts you up or someone doesn't do this in the exact time you want them to do it. There's anger everywhere. Why? Because life is about following our heart. And if someone gets in your way, then you get angry. You're anxious because you don't know what your own heart is. You don't know who you are. And so there's all this anger and anxiety, which is just tangible. You feel it and see it wherever you go. So people are feeling fried. They're cracked and fried. What? Why? Because it comes back. You can't have the kingdom without the king. People want the kingdom, but they don't want Jesus. And you can't have it because Those things are so intrinsically linked to Jesus. Just a bit more. It's a bit doom and gloom, but it's kind of gives us an understanding of it, I guess. There's a lady called Professor Norina Hertz, who's a lecturer at University College London. I think she's more involved in the media now. But two or three years ago, she did a lot of research where she interviewed loads of teenagers, about 2000, I think it was, about their aspirations for life, their fears about life. And she came away saying that today's teenagers, and up to probably about 21, 20, up to the early 20s now, so today's teens and early 20s, she says they are really, should be known as Generation K. And that's Generation K after Katniss Everdeen from the films or the books, if you're more cultured than me, the books, The Hunger Games. And there's been a lot of these kind of films out recently in the last few years, and they're dystopian kind of novels and ideas. And why is she calling them Generation K? Well, it's because, as you see in these films, everywhere around them is corrupt. You can't trust anyone out there. The government's corrupt. Everyone's corrupt. You can't even trust your own family or friends. So who are you left to trust? You just got to trust yourself. And she says that's really the way that so many teens in their 20s are feeling and thinking right now, that these films are very much reflective of what is taking place in wider society. And she says, I think The Hunger Games resonates with them, with Generation K, so much because they are Katniss navigating a dark and difficult world. So what do you do in that when you can't trust anyone? Well, punch today in the face. You just, it's just anxiety everywhere, anger everywhere. And as you continue to look, and it seems, you know, that what we get in the mainstream media as well is that everything around us is being exposed. You get Parliament being exposed for the dodgy expenses or for kind of Brexit lies. Everything gets exposed. Boris Johnson, he's like this. He's really thinking this. Michael Gove, he was doing that. They're just jockeying for position. Everyone gets exposed for who they are. Jeremy Corbyn, look at his history. Look who he's supported. Everyone gets exposed in government. What about the City of London? It got exposed 10 years ago or so with the financial crash. You've got all these bankers, these people who are just so selfish and hoarding money and just focused on their own individual gain. The City of London exposed. And we think, well, is there any respite? Is there any relief? Perhaps your entertainment. Hollywood. Yeah, up until the last few years, Hollywood perhaps was the go-to place. But no, even that's been exposed with Weinstein and all the other types of people being kind of exposed for sexual misconduct and sexual immorality. Everything has been exposed. Silicon Valley, exposed as well. The way they use, you know, Facebook and all that Google have been using data from us. You can't trust them. You can't trust them. You can't trust government, the media. You can't trust anyone. And maybe with Silicon Valley, we think back to the 1985 film, A View to a Kill, and thought, well, James Bond should have let Zorin and Mayday have their way and basically destroy Silicon Valley because of what needs to be, has been exposed recently, all the corruption. Amazon, Starbucks, you know, people saying they're not paying the taxes that they should, exposed. Even our legends in our own culture, and at McParlin, exposed for his drink driving. Everyone just exposed, and it's let down after let down after let down. Everyone's freaking out, and I mentioned earlier that we got a cat from Cats Protection, and I've always been a dog man. I didn't realise how terrible the cat's tongue is. It's like a bit of sandpaper when it licks you. I'm really grim, nothing like a dog's. Anyway, people are feeling that. They think life is as rough as a cat's tongue. What are we going to do? Are we going to freak out with that? Are we going to react like that? Well, listen to what Paul says in Philippians 1, verses 27 to 28. He says, whatever happens, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ, striving together as one for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. This is a sign to them that they will be destroyed, but that you will be saved, and that by God. And Paul's point, even back then, in that Philippian culture, which was, I guess, very similar in many respects to ours, where there's the pressure to conform and the pressure to go along with the way that everyone else is believing and thinking and acting. Paul's saying, look, you know what? Jesus is the light of the world, and his light is exposing the darkness. And although we look at all those things I just mentioned, I mean, go, ah, we can freak out as well. Paul says, don't freak out. People, basically God's, you know, Romans 1 style, handing people over to their own hearts and their own hardness of hearts. Why? Because he does it so that he can have mercy on them, so that people can go, actually, the way we've been living is crazy, it's stupid, it doesn't make sense. It's going to lead to destruction, as he says there. It's not the way forward. What we need is actually to turn back to the true king. And so Paul says that don't get freaked out with everyone else as well. When everyone's anxious and angry at the school or your next door neighbours, be these people who are full of joy in the Holy Spirit. Be these people who are full of peace because you know the God of this universe. So that you shine out as well as those who are different and distinct because you know Jesus. So that's a bit of a snapshot. The next question I'm going to ask is how then did we get here? And there's a million and one routes you can go down to kind of think about this. But just a few. Firstly, how do we get the kind of this cultural air that we're breathing? I put up there this little thinker, a guy called, I'm rubbish at French, so I'd say the Petit Choufleur and all that, but I couldn't call him Jean, no, but Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He basically was a massive thinker, who had a massive influence on what's called the Enlightenment. This way of getting back to, you know, the great thinking of the Greeks and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things he said was basically what we need to do as society, what we need to do as people, is we need to sand ourselves down. We need to strip ourselves back to the bare bones and find out who we really are as human beings. And we need to strip away all those things we mentioned earlier, all these structures, all the ideas of family and society and marriage and tradition and religion. We need to get rid of all of that stuff and just look at ourselves and say, who and what are we? And he came up with this idea that basically, which has been an idea that's been around always, that we are autonomous, that we are self-rulers, that every single one of us is an individual who should rule themselves. That's what autonomous means. So auto meaning kind of self and nomos meaning this Greek word meaning law or rule. So he's saying we should be those who self-rule. You decide for yourself what you do with your life, with your body, with your future. That idea stems and was made very much popular by this guy, Rousseau. So he says we're individuals. Other thinkers around the day, and I don't think this guy's related to John Hobbes, but Thomas Hobbes, he said, look at men as if they had just emerged from the earth like mushrooms and grown up without any obligation to each other. So again, see yourself as an individual. You are in charge of your own life. It's your life. You see yourself as an individual. Throw off all the kind of structures that are thrust upon you. There are none. You are an individual. You determine your reality. You determine life. And go back to Rousseau. So he said in one of his most famous work, probably, The Social Contract, he said, he starts his book by saying, man is born free and everywhere he is in chains. And man is born free and everywhere he is in chains. So what was his idea? If you go to take that kind of the Bible story of creation, fall, and salvation as such. So what was his idea? Well, he had his own little creation myth, his own kind of explanation about how the universe started, what the story of life really is. And he says, you know, in the beginning, man followed his desires of gut and groin. He was obsessed, actually, with sex. And he said, in the beginning, man followed his desires of gut and groin. Whatever he desired, he did and got. That was great. That's how we're supposed to be. That's who we are. We've got good desires going on the inside. But he says, what went wrong? What was the fall? Well, again, it was the outside structures. It was marriage and family. And we see these ideas even today. You know, marriage isn't a word. It's a sentence. That kind of idea. He'd have been like, oh, that's a brilliant joke. I love that one. And you know, all those kind of ideas that marriage is just a bit of paper, they kind of stem from him. They're just kind of things that people impose upon you in your society. But we need to get back, he says, that's where sin happened. We need to get back to this idea of we can do what we want. But obviously, when you get rid of all of the structures of the way that God has made this world, family and marriage and society, then you're going to have a mess. And that's what we're living out today in the Western world. So what was his view of salvation? Well, he said what we need is a new political order. We need a civil religion. We need to get rid of Christianity, put to death Christianity, get rid of that, and all religion, in fact. And then, although he's quite a fan of Islam, because for whatever reasons anyway, but he says, let's get rid of religion, and we should instead impose it on society, and this new kind of political order, where we force people to be free. Spot the contradiction there. But he says, essentially saying anything natural is good, and you should be allowed to do whatever you want. And it's something which you think, wow, he was writing in the 1700s, and that's exactly what people think today. So a couple of implications. He says relationships then are not really part of human nature as it existed originally. They're created by choice. So, you know, you think about things like abortion and the impact that kind of idea would have on that actually there is no, you know, proper relationship between you and that child. It's your body, like, you do what you like with your body. These kind of ideas kind of emanate from this kind of thinking. Relationships aren't something that's intrinsic to humanity. We're not persons, we're individuals, we're cut off from everyone. There aren't no proper relationships. So that everything is just created by your choice. If you want to choose to do that, go for it. Implication number two, the sole source of moral obligations then is the individual will. You choose the colour, it's for the way your life will be. You choose which shade you want to focus on. It's entirely over to you. So that kind of thinking you see kind of jumping through. Another thinker, we're not going to go into it any more at all, but a man called Immanuel Kant, he basically, one of the ideas he kind of really put out there was there is this wedge in reality, and there's two distinct kind of components to reality, where there are what's called the public truths and kind of private beliefs. So public things are proven facts, so things like science and mathematics and those kind of things. He says they're things that are factual and evidential. But private things are things like your religion and your morality and ethics, all those kind of things. Things that you can't prove. They're just whatever you kind of feel by looking in and thinking about it should be the case. You should be able to work these things out for yourself, but they're private. And so he kind of drove this wedge between reality, between private and public. And again, this is something you see throughout our society, something you see in the church as well. We think, why aren't loads of people committed to following Jesus? It's because they've embrace this. They've said, well, yeah, church is for Sunday, it's my private beliefs, I'm going to go into work and do my own thing at work, while I will work and do my job, and I'll separate my Christianity from that job. I won't let my voice ever speak of Jesus, I won't kind of make much mention of Jesus, because that's private, that's my own private idea, it's not public truth, it shouldn't be out there in the public realm. And you see this lack of commitment, why? Because we often so often split life into these two areas. So Immanuel Kant said, public truths are the ones that are factual, like science and maths, and ones you can work out through the senses. The only problem with this, the big problem with it, is that you can't work out this dichotomy is actually true through your senses. It's just unprovable. So it's a crazy idea that he comes out with. And I guess if you're John McEnroe, you might say, Immanuel, you can't be serious. What are you doing? So it's a dad joke. It's legitimate now. I've got two kids. Anyway, so there's some of the ideas that are quite popular. Let's do a quick snapshot of other things. So there's some beliefs that crop up, and we'll see in a moment from the Bible why that is. Just some other things, some other kind of cultural factors. These are things that are not necessarily going to be right or wrong things. They're just things that are the way they are today. And of course you can look back for reasons why, but these are things that are present now and things that kind of help, if you like, provide the fertile breeding ground for the beliefs we've been talking about to spring up and grow up into the hearts and minds of our society. So here are four kind of things that are present currently in the 21st century Western world. So things like capitalism. The whole idea here of capitalism has basically caused the reorganisation of social structures and of everything for the purposes of manufacturing and consumption. So it's kind of made us perpetually frustrated because we're always being told you haven't got what you need, you need this, you need that, you need this, you need that. And so we're perpetually frustrated and anxious because we haven't got these things that we're told we need for life. And we're dissatisfied constantly because of the culture we live in. It's a capitalist-run culture which works on the basis that you need to buy more products and produce more products and buy more products and produce them. So this perpetual, again, the hamster wheel thing again. And it makes us into consumers in life generally. And what will I get out of this? So again, you can see it in church commitment and things like that. What will I get out of this? And even in evangelism, I won't speak here because I won't get what I want out of this. Someone might not like me. You see it everywhere. Technology, what has that done? Well, it's provided this fertile breeding ground for our beliefs because it effectively says whatever is most efficient is most ethical. So whatever's the latest is the greatest. Whatever is the newest is the truest. It's this kind of idea. It's made us pragmatists, sensationalists. Let's go for that immediate thrill straight away. And so we're rubbish at delayed gratification. We can't hold ourselves back because I must have it because of consumerism. I must have it because technology says you must get things instantly and straight away. And we're living in this world where these beliefs are kind of fueled by just the way that we live as a Western world. And in fact, across the world. Urbanisation. Multicultural environments. Kind of, if you like, help pander to the cries of pluralism and self-expression and lifestyle choice. And again, this isn't a comment about whether multiculturalism is right or wrong or whatever. It's just saying this is the way our societies are now. Everywhere you can meet people from all over the world in pretty much any town you go to. There's such a multicultural environment. And when there's so many lifestyle choices out there, like different lifestyles out there, we think, well, I could choose that one or that one. They're like that, they're like that. I could reinvent myself. And do your own thing. Telecommunications, you know, the increase of the internet, again, not a bad thing in and of itself. It's how we use these things. You know, God gives us good gifts. We could twist them and distort them, or we can use them well. But it's made everyone really citizens of the world, so you get to know what's happening everywhere, and it's a media-saturated culture where you're bombarded constantly in your phone and in your home by information that's disconnected from wisdom. You just pom, boom, 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 boom. And we don't know what to do with it. We don't know how to process that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of things that are taking place. People filter out truth. You know, in Christianity, if you like, we see, so just going to whistle through these slides. In Christianity, we see actually life very differently to what have been shown because Christianity, we see there's a core to life. It's like, life is like an apple. There is a core to reality and we build off that core. But in the secular kind of mindset, life is more like a red onion or any onion, that there is no core to reality. We're here by accident. So if you get bored, just peel back another layer. And if you don't like that layer, peel back another. If you don't like that one, peel back another layer. But the problem is that people get to this stage where they peel back so much, there's nothing there in the end. And they realise that, and that's why they're so kind of anxious. So it's a place of truth decay. These are some of the key ideas. People are relativistic about truth. They don't believe there's any absolutes. Those that are true for all people in all times, in all places. So they're pluralistic, which means, well, if there's no absolute truth, then any truth claim is equally valid. You go for it. I was chatting to a guy actually last week at Leicester University. He was very adamant about that, except, you know, obviously his claim to knowing the truth, he didn't quite realise, put himself on a pedestal. But it's that kind of idea. All truths are equally valid. And so people are suspicious when Christians come along and say, actually, this is the truth, because we have embraced this idea that no one is completely right on things. So let me just finish with two things, two more points, and then, there's more slides, but two more kind of issues on your sheet. And then if you want to ask questions or just chip in with your own thoughts on it, it'll probably be really helpful to hear what you've got to say. Why is this taking place? Well, we've seen that, you know, a lot of the kind of historical bits of thinking, but why are people believing this cultural error? And let's look at something that the Bible says about as to why it's happening. In Colossians chapter 2, you can turn to this if you want, or you can look up on the screen. Paul says there, he writes, "See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the elemental spiritual forces of this world, rather than on Christ." So why are people embracing these kind of ways of life? It's because they're being taken captive, because they've been promised that this is what's going to sort out your heart's desires, this will fulfill your life. They've been given all these promises, but it's, if you like, it's a bit like a Mars Easter egg. It promises much, but it never delivers much because they don't taste that great. But also, when you open the egg, you'll be promised that inside is all this greatness. And you start living life this way, and you crack open the egg, and it's just nothing there. It's empty. It's hollow. And Paul's saying every belief system out there that isn't centered on Jesus is hollow and empty. But it's alluring. It looks good. It sounds good. But it just isn't. And what are those things based on? Well, they're based on what we just looked at, human tradition, so different ideas that are pumped out there into our societies. But it also depends on the elemental spiritual forces of this world. They're satanic, they're demonic, if you like. There's these demonic type beings, fallen angels, if you like, behind these belief systems, pumping these out and trying to persuade people to believe them. You know, when you look at the way that Satan so often works in the Bible, you go back even to the very beginning in the Garden of Eden, he doesn't tend to start with using hard power, coming in there and whacking people with a big kind of stick and mallet and telling Eve, you must eat of that tree and I'm going to make sure you do. Now, he comes in a much more kind of soft way, in a soft power. He comes with an idea. Did God really say? And he starts throwing out these little kind of seeds of doubt. He comes with these very subtle ideas. And Paul says we've got to realise that our friends out there and family and our society out there, they're being duped. They're being subtly distorted with these ideas. And half the time, and most of the time, they don't even realise that's happening. And I think it's very important that we as Christians don't go out, right, after this I'm going to go out and I'm going to start saying, you're thinking this because of this reason, and start bashing them with these things. You know, Paul says our battle isn't against flesh and blood, but it's against these principalities and these powers. We're there to try and help people see the problems of their worldview, but do it, in, as we'll see in a few moments in another session, graciously and openly. So life, if you like, is hollow. Without Jesus, Satan is behind these ideas, pumping these ideas through people who are kind of loving these ideas because it's all, he just wants to cause chaos, and that is what he's causing. But Paul says something else in Colossians 2. He says, actually, what we need to realise as Christians is that life has a centre. So if a secularised worldview is a bit like a Mars Easter egg, promises much, but you crack it open, it's empty in the middle, and the chocolate doesn't even taste that great. What is life like according to Paul? Well, it's more like a cream egg. Beautiful Cadbury's chocolate, and it's a lovely fondant centre to it. Oh yeah, I'm salivating now. Yeah, I've got to turn away from the picture. But there's this sweetness, because Jesus is what life is about. There's a sweetness. When you crack open the egg of Jesus, you see life oozing out, life pouring out. Paul writes, Christ is the one in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So he gives us this understanding. Lots of false worldviews out there because people listen to humans and demonic influences, often without knowing it, but that's what happens. But actually, as Christians, we realise life has a centre, and we're to live out our lives going, actually, this stuff sounds so alluring out there, but Jesus is the one who is full of sweetness and truth and wisdom. So I'm going to listen to him above everyone else. What do we need? And then a time for questions and things. What do we need then? We need to do what Jesus does in John chapter 8. If just a quick look at John 8. People at Elsa, people in our world, need what? They need to hear the gospel. This is where we're kind of building up to. It sounds all bleak out there, but actually, in this bleakness, in this darkness, we've got the light of the world. We've got the one who is the truth and speaks the truth. And so in many respects, I think, it isn't that sense a time to be fearful. It's a time to go, poor people out there, come and hear about Jesus. Come and see that he is the answer. He is the one that you really need. Just look at John 8, and I'll just read briefly, make a few comments. So John 8 and verse 31. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, if you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. They answered him, we're Abraham's descendants and never been slaves of anyone. How can you say we should be set free? Jesus replied, very truly I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now a slave has no permanent place in a family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. And Jesus, these statements certainly aren't unique to me, but Jesus really brings out three things, I think, that's amazing here. He tells them, tells the crowd, and it's the same stuff we need to be telling people as well, that freedom is not what you think. And it might be a surprise, like it's a surprise to Bob on the screen there, to people. Because everyone assumes, what is freedom? It's about looking within, following your heart, following your desires. And Jesus says, no, that's not what freedom is. He says, freedom is what? It's freedom is the truth. It's about listening to the truth, believing the truth, and living out the truth. And it's the truth that sets you free. I think sometimes if we say that to people who aren't Christians, they can say, well, yeah, but Christianity's got rules and regulations and it restricts you. But the fact is, every single belief system has rules and regulations that restrict you on one level or not. No belief system has infinitely elasticated boundaries. Every belief system has things that are in and things that are out, beliefs that are good and ones that are bad, beliefs that are true and beliefs that are false. And everyone's making truth claims. You know, the Dalai Lama, a few years back, was being interviewed, and he said something along the lines of, whether Jew, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, it is wrong to try to convert. And it sounds so noble at first, then you think, hang on, what's he doing? He's trying to convert us to his way of thinking. He's doing the very thing he's telling us we shouldn't be doing. And it's everyone's doing it. Everyone's pumping out ideas of that truth. If you believe this, life would be better. You know, just imagine if you started a pie-eating society. I think we should all start one of these. And then someone comes along and says, I want to, you know, because what you're about is pies society. You're about pies, eating them, talking about them, all that kind of stuff. And someone comes along and says, I want to talk about Haribo today. And they bring some Tangfastics and some Star Mix and some Kiddies Mix, whatever. And they say, let's talk about Haribo and let's eat them. And sooner or later you'd have to say, look, as delicious as Haribo are, we're not about Haribo, we're about pies. You know, we could talk about Fray Bentos, Pucker, Steak and Kidney, Short Crust Pastry. You know, we could talk about all these different pies, but we're here to talk about pies. That's who we are. We're a pies eating society. You see, every single belief system has boundaries. And no matter what it is, whether it's Christianity, whether it's another religion, whether it's atheism. And I think we just need to say to people, Jesus comes along and says that freedom is actually listening to the truth. And the question is then, which of all these belief systems out there, as we chat to people, is true? And we say, well, Jesus actually says the truth isn't just a bunch of propositions out there, it's actually himself. He is the way, the truth, and the life. And Jesus says he will set us as free. So then the second point that he makes, and again I think it's one worth making as we hang out with non-Christians, is that Jesus says you're not as free as you think. Everyone's thinking, oh, I was born free, I've been enslaved by what everyone tries to tell me. Now I'm free because I've really worked out that I should follow my heart. And Jesus comes along and says, no, you're not as free as you think. And what was the response when he said it here? Well, all the Jews started getting really offended. They started going, oh, you've offended me. If they were on a Twitter sphere, they'd be, you know, typing that out. I'm offended. How dare you? Shame on you. They'd be shaming Jesus for this. They would say, look at my pedigree. We're Jewish people. We're descendants of Abraham. We've never been slaves of anyone. And it didn't take Sherlock Holmes to go, what about the Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, you know, Persians, and even the Romans, even at the very time they were speaking. They had been slaves, and they in fact were slaves to sin, Jesus says. And what is sin? It's, you know, centering your life on something other than Jesus. It's rebellion against God. It's unbelief. Sometimes people say, well, I know, I think for myself. And you think, no, you don't. You're so kind of bound up by the outside influences. In fact, you know, Silicon Valley knows your heart better than you do. People know you better than you do. Media know your heart better than you do. You don't think for yourself. You think through the lenses and the ideas of what other people have impacted and input into your life. I'll ignore those because it'd be good to open up for it in a minute. But the final point there is just to say that Jesus is more freeing than you think. And that's the key thing to say to people. And to be believing this ourselves, because it's true. Jesus says, very truly I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. So everyone's doing their own thing and you're a slave to that. Now a slave, verse 35, has no permanent place in a family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if a son sets you free, you're free indeed. And I think it's worth saying to people, look, Jesus says that all of us are stuck. All of us are the same. We're all stuck in the mud. Like this boy, we can't go anywhere. Like that game you play when you're a kid, you're stuck in the mud. But Jesus is saying he's the only one who's actually genuinely free. He's the only one who can run around and liberate you. And and say to people, you know, that's either the height of arrogance or the height of accuracy. It's one or the other. And I think as you look at Jesus' life, you come away convinced it's the height of accuracy. And Jesus here says that you're slaves, but because I'm God the Son, I'm the only one running around free. And I'm, in a weird metaphorical way, I'm the only one who wants to can run under your legs to get you running, get you living life as you're meant to. And I love this contrast between slavery and sonship here, because we've all got this longing for home. We all want to be in a place where we are known and relaxed and just at peace. And Jesus is saying, look, I'm the one who can set you free from your slavery to following your own heart, doing your own thing, into relationship with the God who's there, into this amazing family. And as we talk to people, let's explain, you know, who Jesus is, who God is. And when people say, oh, well, doesn't, you know, a lot of people think God is a bit like Kim Jong-un. He's a bit of a nightmare, a despot. But we say, no, if you want to know what God is like, look at Jesus and you see what he's like exactly. He's beautiful, he's good and he's true. And we can say to people, how do you know you can trust him? Well, you know, because just after this, he was going to go and die on a cross for us and take our sins upon himself, take that judgment for us. That's how we know we can trust him, because he's poured out everything for us. And none of the other things you're living for can ever set you free like Jesus. So we've got good news to tell people. We've got brilliant news to tell people. And we're going to focus more on that in a few moments. Sorry, we've got 5 minutes. I've gone very super speedy. But we've got 5 minutes for kind of comments or questions. And feel free to do either or. Yeah.
In my experience, starting right at the beginning, when you said sinners, anything that's not right, a lot of people, if they say they're atheists, don't even have any understanding of what sin is.
Yeah.
Because sin is, by definition, contrary to what the Lord wants. And if they have no belief in God, they're certainly not going to worry about sin. That's something that would be worth. In other words, they want the kingdom, but without the king. And again, they have no concept of God, and so what they want is just there. And it seems quite hard to say, put this idea across, that this is actually God's world that they're trying to better themselves in.
Yeah, brilliant. So kind of points about the kind of sin, and atheists don't have any kind of concept of sin as such. Yeah, and I think in response to that, what I was trying to say was that they have a... So every other worldview and belief system will be, it's kind of like parasitic. It has to kind of launch onto the Christian one, because people can't escape reality. And so, although, yeah, people wouldn't say, they wouldn't use sin as is the correct way of using it, they would have a kind of secularized version of it. So that's what I was trying to show with those different kind of philosophers as well, that they have a secularized version of the Christian story, because there's no escape from it. You know, that's why in every film, well, not in every film, most films, you get the same kind of creation, fall, redemption, consummation thing. It's not because they're thinking we trust the Bible or anything, but it's because they cannot escape from the human story. And so what I was trying to say in terms of sin is that they have their own view of what life is about, creation story. They have their own view of what's wrong with the world. They think something is wrong with the world, and they'd, you know, say, this is what's wrong. And so I'm saying, in their mindset, this is sin. It's not, I'm not talking about they'd be using a Christian mindset. They're just saying this is their understanding of what's wrong with the world. So it's kind of going along that. And certainly, you know, the king without a kingdom. Again, I'm not saying that they would be thinking, we want all the things we can get from Jesus, but we don't want Jesus. They've suppressed the truth so much so often that they don't even realise any of that. But what they do want is they want justice, they want equality. So they want all these things, but they don't realise what they're doing in it, but I think because of suppressing the truth. So this is objectively what they're doing, but they don't actually so often realise, because like Romans 1 says, like the, you know, the cafetiere thing, they plunge, they suppress the truth, they push it down and no longer see it, and so are kind of like clueless really as to what's going on so often. So I think what I was trying to say, basically a secularised version of it. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, a lot of time it's people's, they don't want their eyes opened.
Yeah.
Because they realise they've got to give up what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
But you remind them it's only the bad stuff that God wants you to give. And you say we've got laws as Christians.
Yeah.
We have, but they're only for a good.
Yeah.
Not health.
Yeah.
Because God loves us.
Yeah, yeah.
And by saying in Corinthians 3 about us all wanting to share what is good. Like if you buy something new, you like to share with your friends what you brought.
Yeah.
As in that, our love for God, that God loves us, we want to share that with others, so it's planting seeds.
Yeah.
Because only the Lord can save.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
Can open but to plant in small seeds and let them grow and God cultivate them.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And you're right. So the rules that God gives, let's say, share to people why they're good. And I think that's very important, like, particularly when on things like, you know, sexual ethics and things like that. Let's actually, you know, someone like Jordan Peterson, I don't know if many people have heard him at the moment, but he's very popular at the moment, I think, because he's convinced by what he believes, and he's passionate about just sharing it, and he's not afraid to say it. And I think as Christians, we've got to be far more like that and go, actually, what God says about sex is brilliant, it's great news, and here's reasons why, and explain it to me, and actually be excited about what God says. And I found as well, particularly the last few weeks, when I've been talking to various students who've come up to me and said, I'm bisexual, or I'm homosexual, being able just to share what God says and why it's good, there's actually been, you don't always get this response, but actually people were getting quite choked by actually what God has said, and quite like, wow, okay, I'd never thought about that. So yeah, you're right. Let's talk up why God says what he says, and these are good things. Thanks. Yeah. Yeah.
Stuff like that, and trying to, I guess, change their mind on what the church is about, what Christianity is about. For me, it's been the hardest thing.
Yeah.
How do you go about?
So there's different scandals of the church, you mean? Yeah.
It has got quite a negative image.
Yeah.
In my generation, at least.
Yeah. And I think that's partly because of what we, you know, what we're saying, I mean, largely because of what we're saying is in people without realising it have embraced this notion that any institution or anything in authority is just trying to gain control and power over you. So they naturally think that about anything, family, schools, church, society, police. Yeah, it's a kind of, you know, that kind of issue. I think when I talk to people and people say, what about, you know, the hypocrisy of the church? Say, yeah, Christians are completely flawed people. We don't proclaim to be great, and some people who profess to be Christians aren't actually Christians. Some people actually have done the things you talked about as Christians, and that's horrific, and they need to repent of that and receive God's grace and be forgiven. But I said, as Christians, we come as beggars, saying that we found bread, we found Jesus. Jesus has found us in that sense. He's given us himself. He's given us his life. And so we're just other people who are flawed people saying, look, to other people who are flawed, this is where real life is. And so I think it's just like a bit of humility and honesty and going, yeah, where we're wrong, let's tell them where we're wrong. Because people never admit where they're wrong these days, you know. I think that's quite refreshing, I found, when leaning towards the students. I think when you're talking honestly about things, people are refreshed by that because they don't hear it. They always hear an excuse, or if I've offended you, I'm sorry. Or if you took it this way, which is never an apology. So you're actually going, yeah, that is wrong, but look at Jesus and get on to Jesus, I think. Yeah. Great. Thank you. Yes. Oh, David Watson. Hello.
When you're talking about consumerism, do you think that this is driven by something I've heard referred to as FOMO, fear of missing out?
Yeah, I mean, there's a Times article written by a guy called Eric Barker, or Baker or Barker, in 2016, where he talked about that and about loads of interviews that have been done again with certainly teens, and that being a massive issue for a lot of them. So I think there's a lot of the fear of missing out. And I think, yeah, just the image management, that you've got to keep yourself looking good to the outside world. I think there's a lot of that going on. So there's a whole bunch of different issues, I think. You know, in one sense, you know, we say, you know, I don't think he's got a coherent strategy in the sense of he's saying, I want everyone to become fully fledged postmodernists or consumerists. He's just like, I want people to be chaotically messed up. And so I will try anything and everything. That bit of consumerism over there, a bit of that over there, I don't care. I'm just going to throw out all these confusion bombs everywhere. So I think, you know, one, he's got a coherent strategy, as in he wants to take people down, as Jesus says in John 8, after the verses we read. He wants to kill people. But I think consumerism is certainly part of that. But I think there's so many other angles as well, and so many other things people are getting sucked into, including us as Christians. You know, because we get so obsessed with our own, well, what are you doing with your kitchen? Oh, I've done this, I've done this, I've done that. We're so into it. I see it in my own life all the time. I'm like, oh, it's disgusting. I'm just doing the very things that I'm actually trying to critique. And it's so all pervasive. But there's a really interesting documentary you can watch by, it was the BBC. It was done in 2002, but it's called The Century of the Self. And it's a series of four 1-hour episodes. And it's brilliant at critiquing our obsession with self, looking at people like Freud, but also looking at Freud's nephew. I've gotten his name for a minute, I'll remember it in a minute. But he's... Sorry? Did someone mention his name? Sorry? Freud's nephew I was thinking of. But he basically is the father of public relations in the 20th century. And he was brilliant at basically getting people's mindsets around to whatever he wanted. Because he said, and learning from his uncle, that you need to appeal to desire. People aren't rational beings, they actually are driven by their desires. And he started pumping this out into actually consumerism, and it's a fascinating kind of critique of how we're all just sucked in to these ways of thinking. So yeah, the century of the self, and the guy's name's just escaping me for a moment. But it was his nephew, Freud's nephew. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, they're all related. I mean, it's all interrelated, because a lot of Darwinism kind of kicked off because of the worldview that he was embracing in that time, and the myth of progress, which was this Enlightenment idea. And then Darwin's science kind of slots in very nicely to this idea where we started like this and we're getting better and better and better. So there's massive Darwinian influences everywhere. But it's a brilliant book. Again, this is not a Christian. A guy called Tom Bethel, who's called Darwin's House of Cards. It's a really great critique. He actually went to university with Richard Dawkins, same age, and went to Oxford. And he's not a Christian, he always had questions about Darwinism. And he's been a journalist all his life, and he's a leading one in the States. And he's interviewed lots of leading evolutionary scientists to say, I've always had this problem, what about this? And it basically says it's a house of cards that is going to collapse. Yeah, and it's more to say, I guess, Descartes put their cart before the horse. But I end on that one. Thanks.
On that joke, let me interrupt. Thank you, Martin. So refreshment break time now.